For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. My first job was at news in radio job was at News 1000 KTOK, and the morning show host at the time was Mike McCarville. We learned earlier this week the commentator and journalist died after a long illness. Neva, you worked closely with McCarville. I just wanted to get your thoughts on his passing.
Absolutely. I mean, Mike was an incredible friend. We worked side by side and maintained a friendship for more than 35 years, and he's someone that I think as we looked yesterday and through the past days as his passing was made known, what we saw were how many lives and how many people had been influenced, impacted, and really counted him as a true friend. I mean, here's someone whose journalistic integrity was beyond reproach, someone that just a few years ago went into the Oklahoma Journalism Hall of Fame, something that was certainly well-deserved. And I think when we really look at Mike's career, I mean, he's someone that really exemplified both in the political arena, and we were in the trenches, the political trenches, many times together, as well as in the realm of journalism, someone who really was a journalist. He wanted to just have the news, present the news, and make it factual and to the point. And I think that's something that, as a lot of people reflect back on Mike's life, they really would like to see more of it. And I certainly am in that group. So I certainly send my condolences and best wishes to the family, and he's someone that will be missed in the state of Oklahoma.
And certainly, Ryan, he might not have been someone we always agreed with on his opinions, but well, you could not shake a stick at his journalistic integrity.
Absolutely. Well, Aniva's absolutely right. I mean, so even if, I mean, he had an opinion, and there was no doubt about that, but he would report news that was unfriendly to Republicans. I mean, he would break news that Republicans didn't want to be broken as well. So, you know, his journalistic integrity was there. There are only a handful of people that ever rise to the level of being able to have the kind of impact in the political world and the media world that Mike McCarville has. And just on Facebook, just watching folks come back and remember instances and memories, and many journalists talking about they got their start working with Mike on radio, sometimes working with him in print on his newsletter that ultimately went online to the McCarville Report, that was an indispensable source of Oklahoma political news, and I think still will remain that. But even for, you know, liberal Democrats like myself, that was one of those websites that you pick up and you go to and you rely on it for what's really happening out there at the state capitol, in particular during session.
And I think he was someone who really believed in civil discourse. I mean, he was not someone who wanted to be shrill. He was not someone that wanted to score a cheap political point. He's someone that just wanted to be in the arena and do it the right way. And, you know, when you look at the other kind of elements of his life and career. I mean, here's someone who served in the United States Army with a exemplary career there, someone that served as a press secretary to Governor Dewey Bartlett, someone who, you know, had many avenues and many places of service, certainly was someone highly respected in the Republican Party, and the Republican Party gave their highest award just a couple of years ago to Mike for his lifetime of service to the Republican Party in that era when he was really in the political trenches, being very active in political campaigns. So I think he is an icon and someone that I think we can all smile and remember and reflect back on our own personal stories. And like you, Michael, I mean, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today at KOSU 19 years later had it not been for Mike McCarville, who had been involved in commentary with the station here. And then as he moved on, put my name in the hopper, and here I am today. So I'm grateful on many fronts, but most of all for his friendship.
The state Supreme Court throws out the challenge against its newest justice, Patrick Weirich. The ACLU argued Weirich didn't have actual residence in the district he was selected to represent. Ryan, what happened here?
Well, you know, Justice Watt, in a concurring opinion in which he dissented in part, said that this was one of the most critical issues to ever face the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And I happen to agree with that. I also happen to agree with the idea that even though we disagree with outcomes from the Supreme Court from time to time, we agree with the outcomes from the courts from time to time. At the end of the day, it's the prerogative of the Supreme Court to say what the law is and what the Constitution is. We happen to disagree here with their outcome, but that's the way it works. The state Supreme Court essentially said that our clients, two residents of the 2nd Judicial District, the Oklahoma Constitution guarantees geographic representation on the Supreme Court. These two residents said, we don't believe that there's evidence, and there's actually evidence to the contrary, that Justice Weyrich is a resident of the 2nd Judicial District. The Supreme Court did not reach the merits on that. They didn't look at the evidence. They dismissed it for standing. They said that our clients weren't the appropriate parties to bring that challenge. They did leave open the door for the Attorney General, although that's unlikely, or a district attorney, also probably unlikely, or one of the other judges that was considered by the JNC and forwarded to the governor for her consideration of appointment. They could bring that challenge. And so there still could be some challenges out there. Ultimately, I think that the people need to have confidence in the judiciary. We certainly do. I would encourage the JNC to release the documents that they reviewed and weighing. How do they reconcile the inconsistencies in Justice Weyrich's application with regard to his residency so that we can move past this? As far as our challenge goes, though, it seems that it's over at the moment.
Neva.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that the statement was that it was a collateral attack by private individuals and was not permitted. That was one of the, I think, comments made in the ruling. And I think what we have is resolution, which is what we've talked about. There was a process. There was an attempt to challenge this. The challenge was reviewed by the Supreme Court. A decision was rendered. And now we have a full Supreme Court, and I think it moves forward. So in the future, if there are other issues, I would agree with Ryan. I mean, it does certainly make it important for the JNC and those that begin deliberating in the future about future justices to be sensitive to the fact that it needs to, it certainly needs to pass all of the requirements and thresholds.
This was Governor Fallon's first and possibly only nominee to the Supreme Court. He's in his 30s, so he's going to be there for a long time. Is this quite a coup for, not coup, I don't want to say coup, is this quite an opportunity for Fallon, just kind of a legacy for Fallon, because he'll be on the court for a long time.
It could be. Well, he could be. I mean, I think that a justice as young as Justice Weyrich, you know, will probably at some point be in consideration for appellate judgeships or district judgeships at the federal level, if that's something that he would be interested in. I mean, he's got a long career ahead of him, whether it's on the state Supreme Court or in some other judicial branch at the federal level. You know, I expect that he'll be around for a while. And, you know, the governor has put somebody on the court that will most certainly outlast her term in the governor's mansion. The other point that I think is important to make here is that the Judicial Nominating Commission, as much as we have questions about how they reconcile these inconsistencies in the application, the fact remains that the JNC is far preferable to any sort of a politicized political system where maybe the Senate would be confirming judges that the governor appointed. You know, putting politics into this process wouldn't have resolved the questions that we have right now.
Oklahoma Muslims made an appearance last week at the state capitol to talk to elected officials. One state representative, Salisaw Republican John Bennett, apparently required Muslims to fill out a questionnaire asking questions like, do you beat your wife? And references to the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Neva, while Representative Bennett certainly is in his right to do this, should he?
Well, I think we have a situation here that's very unfortunate. This is the third year that the group has come to the Capitol. It's one of many groups that come to the Capitol to meet the lawmakers, to learn more about the process, and to become more involved as citizens in the process. And so it's regrettable when you have one instance with one representative that not only becomes an issue for all Oklahomans to read about and hear about, but becomes national news. I mean, here are major reports in the Washington Post and other major national publications really seizing on this as another opportunity just to give us a black eye in terms of who we are as a people. So I think that's very regrettable. You're right, Michael. I mean, a representative, they can do as they wish. I mean, and so to suggest that there's some way to stop that, no, there isn't, unfortunately. But I think that what we see is there's no, he has, certainly among his colleagues, you see no one rising up to kind of join on that bandwagon. So I think it's regrettable, but I think that, that those two high school students from Tulsa and the one OCU law student, the three that came to his office, I think those folks need to look at it and step back and remember that there's a lot of good that goes in the process, and there are a lot of good folks that are working in state government, in elected positions at the legislature, and not to use this as the only example to point to.
And Ryan, this really is a black eye, because we when we look at the Muslim Day, it was like, I think the first year they come for 3 years. This is the first year that they actually finally outnumbered the protesters,
right,
who were out there. It would look like they were finally being accepted.
Well, it is, and I want to go back to this point of whether or not it's within his legal right. I believe that there's a possibility that he's violated his oath to uphold the Oklahoma Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 of the state constitution says that there shall be no religious test for an individual to exercise their civil or political rights. So the right to be able to show up in your legislator's office, they don't have to hear you, but the idea that there's a threshold question about your religion before they will even consider hearing you, I believe could possibly be a violation of the state constitution. And you're right. You know, this is Muslim Day at the Capitol has been growing. I've been honored to participate, I believe, in every Muslim Day at the state legislature, working with my good friends at the Council of American Islamic Relations here in Oklahoma, and Adam Sultani and his entire fantastic team. What John Bennett has done is absolutely despicable. And I think that, you know, there's also the issue of where's leadership on this. You know, we can look at John Bennett, but the Speaker of the House, when he was asked to comment on this, you know, he essentially took this dodge and said, well, you know, the folks of his district get to hold him accountable. I'm not going to weigh in on that. He has a duty to weigh in on this, because that kind of rhetoric is dangerous for Muslim Oklahomans. It incentivizes and incites violence against them, discrimination against them. The Speaker speaks for the entire House, and he should speak out against this. Representative Josh Cockcroft, you know, kudos to him, took to Facebook almost immediately and said, everyone is welcome in my Capitol office. You know, I agree with John Bennett on one point, that there are religious extremists in our midst, radicals that are bent on destroying American values. However, he need only look in the mirror to see one of their leaders.
The State House wants to crack down on protests similar to Standing Rock. Last week, lawmakers passed HB 2128, making trespassing protesters liable for damage after passing HB 1123, adding criminal penalties and a $1 million fine against those who protest oil and pipeline infrastructure. Ryan, your thoughts on these bills?
Well, the most recent attack on political speech and civil resistance, which, you know, goes back to our very founding as a nation. You know, we celebrate acts of political resistance in history because they've led us to where we are today, but we look at contemporary acts of civil resistance and we see a current effort to disincentivize them, to keep them from happening. You know, I think of the sit-in movement that was born right here in Oklahoma City with famous civil rights leaders like Clara Luper. They were interrupting commercial activity. They were trespassing. But we look at that and the violence that was brought up on them for standing up for the rights of equal access and end segregation. And we look at them as heroes today. And I think that when we begin to think, you know, 50, 60 years from now, when we look back on folks that are protesting for environmental causes, you know, they could very easily be the heroes of that next generation as well. I think that they're heroes today. These bills are about as anti-American as you can get, because they go against this idea of political discourse. We already have laws on the books to hold people accountable. This most recent bill, House Bill 2128, goes so far as to attach liability upon arrest, not even conviction, but upon arrest, you could be civilly liable for you know, damage that happens as a result of a protest. Even if you don't mean to do that, if you're an organization and you bust somebody somewhere and you have, and it's all peaceful, all legal, and you have an overzealous person who goes out and does something stupid, and or, you know, maybe not even stupid, but just destructive, and then that organization could be held liable for that. That doesn't seem to me to be the kind of the direction that we should be going right now.
Neva.
Well, I think we're kind of mixing the apples and oranges a little bit in this explanation, because what we're really looking at here is not the peaceful sit-ins and protests of the 60s versus what's going on today, because we've got a very different atmosphere. I mean, we've got paid professional groups who are hiring people to go across the country and be professional protesters. And, you know, with that comes a lot of either intended or unintended consequences. Much of that could be property damage and could could be things that that have to be addressed. And while they're already, you're right, Ryan, there are already things that specifically from a legal standpoint are already in place. I think what is being said and what lawmakers are looking at is being very proactive, not only in Oklahoma but across many states that are trying to get ahead of this curve rather than wait for some major disruption where we have a dam or some electrical grid or something that is compromised, or that there's something where there's major destruction, and there have to be some avenues in place to really address this and address it in a very concrete, very specific way. So I think what we're seeing with the Oklahoma legislature is actually an opportunity to kind of get ahead of the curve rather than just react down the road. And I think that the thing to keep in mind is we're talking about the potential for very very professional, organized, paid people to come in, not peaceful protests of people who just are Oklahoma citizens.
Where draw the line then? Where we say when someone says, well, sure, there might be some people paid, but then if you're also going to punish the people who are just regular citizens who want to,
there is still a protocol for folks to be able to have proper, you know, proper protests. But I think there are avenues where you go beyond the scope of what is considered appropriate. And it becomes something that does have to be addressed from a legal standpoint. So, I mean, you know, anytime you get into the legal realm, I mean, it's everybody's version of what they think is right and what they think is debatable. But the bottom line is let's keep some perspective on what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the potential and the growing potential from what we're seeing in other states that could be something that Oklahoma has to deal with as well.
Boy, I hope protests become more professional. That's how they're going to work. I think that we should have strategic, organized, professional protesting organizations that are out engaging in civil resistance. The people that are offering these pieces of legislation, what they want are protests that are incredibly convenient for them. They want people to come to the Capitol Rotunda, hold a rally, and they can walk down the stairwells and avoid them and go out to their luxury cars and drive out to the restaurants and have lunch and come back to the Capitol without ever having felt the impact of the people's voice. The idea of paid protesters, I don't know where this is coming from. You know, the idea that folks are showing up to protest simply because they're getting paid. Show me where that's happening. Give me real actual examples of that. And there's this idea that the sit-in movements, they weren't peaceful. I mean, and they but the violence became because of the people protesting the protesters. And if you think that they were civil and non-disruptive, ask the people whose lunch counters were getting occupied by protesters who couldn't serve their meals. They were entirely disruptive to their commercial activity. And we bust people in from the north to the south. A lot of those folks had their ways paid. And we look at those civil rights marchers that marched in Selma and Birmingham and other cities around the south. A lot of them came here on their own penny, but sometimes they wanted to come, but they couldn't afford it. So folks helped them get here.
But if you're looking at disruptive activists that are really going to take an opportunity to do something very aggressive, they're going to attempt to do something with a treatment plant or one of these oil and gas hubs or a storage facility or anything along that line that could potentially be, you know, could have this kind of violent, aggressive activity against it, you know, and the consequences that come from it. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars potentially that could be, you know, that could be a problem out of this. So the idea that people should passively sit back and say, if it happens, it happens, that let them do it with no forethought on what should be the mechanisms in place and the laws in place to try to mitigate against that, I think is unreasonable. So
we've already got criminal and civil liability attaches.
It doesn't mean they can't expand those and think beyond what
is
currently in place.
If we were expanding this to healthcare facilities instead of just oil and natural gas pipelines, I can promise you
it's not strictly oil and gas pipelines.
But it's critical infrastructure. But if we put a healthcare facility in there, abortion clinics in there, I would ask Oklahomans that are pro-life, that are thinking about this issue, and they're saying, oh, well, I support this. Imagine if somebody came in and said, if you do this at an abortion clinic, Would you still be for this? Because then it would interfere with your right as a pro-life Oklahoman to show up and do a lot of this stuff.
I think even a pro-life Oklahoman does not want to see property destroyed. They don't want to see the threat of property destruction. They don't want to see things done to clinics or anything else. I mean, I think that's where the extremism comes in, and no one wants to see that as part of the part of what takes place.
The State House also passed a measure to increase teacher pay by up to $6,000 after 3 years. Opponents are raising concerns this bill has no funding mechanism. It is headed to the Senate. Neva, do you see any chance of it making it through the upper chamber?
Well, I see the process starting. Okay, so we say let's pass a bill overwhelmingly in the House. We're going to give $1,000 1 year, $2,000, and then $3,000, and the teachers will all be happy about that. But you're right, Michael. Where was the funding mechanism? I mean, $300 million plus, but we don't explain how we're going to come up when we're already in a budget shortfall. The $300 million. So I think we can expect the Senate's going to say, okay, folks, this should have come with some idea of where the money's coming from. So that's where we'll wind up in a conference committee, and that's where we'll wind up with something that probably looks nothing like this bill when it's all said and done. I think both bodies want to try to come up with a plan, but at this juncture, what we haven't seen is any real idea from a budget and appropriations process what's going to happen. And until we see that, I think this is premature. And I think that's what we'll find when it gets to the Senate, is it'll skid to a pretty screeching halt until they can come up with money.
Ryan, Senate President Pro Tem Mike Schultz has said there probably will not be a teacher raise bill this year.
Well, yeah, I think probably is too much of a hedge. I mean, there will not be a teacher pay raise this year. It's not going to happen. And prove me wrong, please. Please, somebody prove me wrong. But I think that the only concrete outcome of this is that it's going to show up as a bullet point on somebody's political mailer or on their Facebook page, saying, "Hey, teachers in my district, I voted for a teacher pay raise." And it's this empty gesture. It's a token to throw to educators in your district. There's no money behind this. I can see what, I mean, folks, you can vote for it. I looked at people that I respected who voted for it, and I understand that. And I looked at folks that I respect who voted against it, and I also understand that, because at the end of the day, this isn't going to happen. And if we want to be honest with the teachers in Oklahoma about where they stand, this is a matter of revenue. Where's the money going to come from? And if we can't answer that question, why tell them we're going to give them something?
And I think the kind of the countertop to a kind of a long, drawn-out pay raise, I mean, a structured pay raise, may be the possibility, and I know there have been some discussions in the building that I understand, perhaps a one-time stipend, maybe $1,000. That's the $53 million figure that keeps being tossed out on the $1,000 figure. So is that a possibility? Well, I mean, they can probably cobble together something if they wanted. Is that a good plan to just kind of do that as kind of, we can't get you a pay raise, we can't really deal with the long-term issue here, but we're going to pass out checks at the end of the year and hope you all don't feel too unkindly toward us.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if that's really going to be something that a majority of these lawmakers are going to have a stomach for or not. And that is the bottom line. I mean, they can dodge the bullet this year, but next year is an election year, yeah, as we always say. And then it becomes a little more of a heated proposition as they go back into their districts to have to really address this, because they've had one session and now they'll be in a different place if they don't do something this year.
Of course, the Amazon sales tax is supposed to raise $300 million. But is there a possibility that they could pass this bill and just simply with no funding at all, just simply tell school districts, "Hey, we gave them a raise. You have to give them $1,000, and then it's up to the school districts to, in essence, what an unfunded mandate."
Yeah, I don't think that that's going to happen. And I think that what would happen there is that school districts would start to lay off teachers. I mean, if you're going to require school districts to, out of their existing budgets, give teachers $1,000 pay raise or $1,000 stipend, you're going to see teachers being laid off. You're going to see support staff being cut. You're going to see services at schools. You know, if we really wanted to get folks' attention in Oklahoma, because apparently whenever we cut things like debate and drama, that doesn't get raised the ire, but turn the lights off on Friday nights. You know, shut those high school basketball games down. Let's these extracurricular activities that, you know, I think that we can say are nice or whatever, but let's shut the lights off. You know, stop hiring coaches and start hiring teachers. And then all of a sudden, these communities are going to, I feel like a lot of folks don't really feel the full impact and the weight of the pressure that our superintendents
and they don't need to wait at the local level in those school districts to have these conversations. They have elected school board members that should be where the real focus is, even more than their lawmakers. I mean, they're the people that are appropriating the dollars. They're the people that are making the decisions at the local level. How many teachers, how many support personnel, how many administrators, and all of the other things that go along with the education in that particular school district. So again, I think it's one of these deals where if folks want to get mad, if folks want to get serious about correcting education problems, start right there at the local level and they'll have much better results more quickly.
Well, the problem, they start at the local level and then somebody goes over their head to the state school board or the state school board association, and then they're the state superintendent, state board of education, and they put a charter school in their district against their will.
Seminole.
It should be the local control. That's not been the case under this current administration.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.